This is Vatican Radio. I'm Tracy McClure. We present Jill Bevilacqua's program, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. Let's listen.
Jesus told his disciples a parable on the necessity of praying always and not losing heart. Once there was a judge in a certain city who respected neither God nor man. A widow in that city kept coming to him, saying, "Give me my rights against my opponent." For a time he refused, but finally he thought, "I care little for God or man. But this widow is wearing me out. I'm going to settle in her favor, or she'll end by doing me violence." The Lord said, "Listen to what the corrupt judge has to say. Will not God then do justice to his chosen, who call out to him day and night? Will he delay long over them, do you suppose? I tell you, he will give them swift justice. But when the Son of Man comes, will he find any faith on the earth?"
Let's go straight to the protagonists in the parable our Lord tells this Sunday. First, the judge, described in different versions as unjust, corrupt, unscrupulous, unrighteous, or simply, as here, as a judge who respected neither God nor man. What kind of justice might anyone expect from a man like this? Certainly a widow, with probably no resources whatsoever, would have little chance of influencing a man of this sort. He would care little for her rights, that's for sure. And indeed, he decides in her favour only because she has worn him out with her persistence, and because he's afraid of what she might do next. Judges, wrote Francis Bacon in 1625, ought to remember that their office is to interpret law, not to make law or give law. And again, let judges also remember that Solomon's throne was supported by lions on both sides. Let them be lions, but yet lions under the throne. Solomon's wisdom as a judge has come down to us in one of the most famous of all Bible stories, that of the two women who claimed the same child. Both had given birth at the same time, but one of the babies had died. Each claimed that the live child was hers. To Solomon they went for a judgment as to whom the child belonged. "Bring me a sword," ordered Solomon, "and I will cut the child in half, so that each may have half." And at this the true mother cried out in protest, "Let her have the child, but do it no harm." And so Solomon knew she was the child's mother, and handed her the babe. Judges of such calibre may be few and far between, but there are not many who have gone down in history as failing totally in their almost sacred task. There have been those one would not have relished meeting, such as the notorious Judge Jeffreys, whose trials in the English West Country of the followers of the Duke of Monmouth, rebels against the crown, earned him the name of the Hanging Judge. Certainly men and women of the law, be they judges or advocates, walk a tightrope in a world where one false step, the acceptance of a single bribe, means the loss of personal integrity, never to be recovered. A man there was, himself the son of a judge, who followed the profession of advocate, and of whom it was written that,
"In all his great offices and doings for the king and the realm, so many years together, had from all corruption of wrongdoing or bribes taking, kept himself so clear that no man was able therewith once to blemish him or make just quarrel against him."
The man was Sir Thomas More, Lord Chancellor of Henry VIII, executed by the king in 1535 for refusing to recognise him as head of the English Church, and canonised saint 400 years later. But despite this declaration of More's integrity, quoted from the Life of More written by his son-in-law, William Roper, attempts were made to blacken More's name by suggesting that he had accepted bribes. In Robert Bolt's play about Moore, A Man for All Seasons, the dramatist uses the example of the woman who sent Moore a silver cup, in the hope that when she brought her case before him, he would give judgment in her favour. But, the character says, as soon as he realised it was a bribe, he got rid of it. Moore was very well aware of the implications of accepting a bribe. As he says in the play, in office they offer you all sorts of things. The point was to be able to distinguish between a genuine gift and one which compromised the recipient. In one famous case, Moore was accused by a certain Parnell, against whom Moore had made a decree while Lord Chancellor, of having received a bribe from his adversary, a certain Vaughan. In Roper's words,
this Parnell to His Highness most grievously complained that Sir Thomas More, for making the same decree, had of the same Vaughan, unable for the gout to travel abroad himself, by the hands of his wife, taken a fair great gilt cup for a bribe.
The matter came before the Council of Lords, and Parnell told his tale and swore that Moore had admitted receiving the cup. But Thomas Moore was not only incorruptible, he was an astute lawyer and diplomat, and he had a delightful sense of humour. Roper tells us what happened next.
Whereupon Sir Thomas More desired their lordships that as they had courteously heard him tell the one part of his tale, so they would vouchsafe of their honours indifferently to hear the other. After which obtained, he further declared unto them that, albeit he had indeed, with much work, received that cup, yet immediately thereupon he caused his butler to fill it with wine, and of that cup drank to her, and that when he had done so, and she pledged him, then as freely as her husband had given it to him, even so freely gave her the same unto her again, to give unto her husband as his New Year's gift, which, at his instant request, though much against her will, at length yet she was fain to receive, as herself and certain other there presently before them deposed. Thus was the great mountain turned scant to a little molehill.
And Roper cannot resist another story in the same vein.
So I remember that at another time upon a New Year's Day, there came to him one Mistress Crocker, a rich widow, for whom, with no small pain, he had made a decree in the Chancery against the Lord Arundel, to present him with a pair of gloves and £40 in gold coin, in them for a New Year's gift. Of whom he thankfully receiving the gloves, but refusing the money, said unto her, Mistress, since it were against good manners to forsake a gentlewoman's New Year's gift, I am content to take your gloves, but as for your money, I utterly refuse. So, much against her mind, enforced he her to take her gold again.
From judges now, let us pass to widows, often cited in the scriptures. In the words of our Lord, the widow's mite, which was worth more than all the rest of the offerings cast into the temple treasury, because she of her want cast in all she had. And just before, he'd been telling the people to beware of the scribes, who devour the houses of widows under the pretense of long prayer. Our Lord's compassion for the widow of Nain and his restoring of her son to life. Back in the Old Testament, the Mosaic law declared, you shall not afflict any widow or orphan. If you do afflict them and they cry out to me, I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath will burn. And St. James in his letter declares that religion that is pure and undefiled before God and the Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their affliction, and to keep oneself unstained from the world. Alas, none of these laws or instructions or acts of pity towards widows would have moved our unjust judge. One thing and one thing alone decides him to act in favour of the widow, her persistence. Like the dominant note in music, her plea cannot be ignored. In his poem A Toccata of Galuppi's, Robert Browning imagines Galuppi, the 18th century composer from the island of Burano near Venice, sitting at the clavichord and exclaims, "Hark, the dominant's persistence, till it must be answered to." And in the different versions of today's gospel, the theme is always the same, to persevere in prayer. Always to pray and not lose heart. Pray continually and never lose heart. We ought always to pray and not to faint. That last is a vivid image used often by writers. Shakespeare has one character say of another, "He prays but faintly and would be denied." And a 17th century metaphysical poet, Francis Quarles, wrote, "He teaches to deny that faintly prays." And Shakespeare again in Troilus and Cressida has Ulysses say to Achilles, who's losing heart, "Perseverance, dear my lord, keeps honour bright. To have done is to hang quite out of fashion, like a rusty mail in monumental mockery." Mail, of course, meaning coat of mail, for Ulysses was talking to a soldier. In our own Vatican Radio Almanac of Evening Thoughts, for September the 20th of the year 2000, we find these words of the French 19th century writer Victor Hugo. "Almost the whole secret of great souls is contained in this word, persevere." What emerges from these various reflections on perseverance in prayer seems to be that before we get a positive answer, we're going to have a lot of negative ones, or none at all. That this happens to even the most fervent of clergymen is borne out by this poem written by the man who's been described as the most purely devotional of English poets, George Herbert, 17th century metaphysical poet and country parson. Here now is Denial.
"When my devotions could not pierce thy silent ears, then was my heart broken, as was my verse. My breast was full of fears and disorder. My bent thoughts, like a brittle bow, did fly asunder. Each took his way. Some would to pleasure go, some to the wars and thunder of alarms. As good go anywhere, they say, as to benumb both knees and heart, in crying night and day, 'Come, come, my God, O come!' But no hearing. Oh, that thou shouldst give dust a tongue to cry to thee, and then not hear it crying. All day long my heart was in my knee, but no hearing. Therefore my soul lay out of sight, untuned, unstrung, my feeble spirit unable to look right, like a nipped blossom hung discontented. Oh, cheer and tune my heartless breast, defer no time, that so thy favors granting my request, they and my mind may chime and mend my rhyme."
The great Teresa of Avila admitted that for years she'd found it hard to concentrate in prayer. But she wrote that God does not leave us without help if we approach him humbly. If a whole year passes without receiving what we ask, we should be ready to try longer. Such time is well spent. And the Indian poet Rabindranath Tagore puts the same thought into his own unique words.
"Clouds heap upon clouds, and it darkens. Love, why dost thou let me wait outside at the door all alone? In the busiest moments of the noontide work, I am with the crowd, but on this dark, lonely day, it is only for thee that I hope. If thou showest me not thy face, if thou leavest me wholly aside, I know not how I am to pass these long, rainy hours. I keep gazing on the faraway gloom of the sky, and my heart wanders wailing with the restless wind. If thou speakest not, I will fill my heart with thy silence and endure it. I will keep still and wait like the night with starry vigil and its head bent low with patience. The morning will surely come, the darkness will vanish, and thy voice pour down in golden streams breaking through the sky. Then thy words will take wings in songs from every one of my birds' nests, and thy melodies will break forth in flowers in all my forest groves."
Perseverance is recommended to us, as we've seen, not only in prayer, but in all the circumstances of life. As the old saying goes, if at first you don't succeed, try, try, try again. When we consider qualities we'd like to possess or would like others to possess, we often look to the animal world for our examples, particularly the insect world. The industry of ants is proverbial, but there's another insect whose display of perseverance gave rise to a celebrated story. At the beginning of the 14th century, a Scottish earl named Robert Bruce joined the War of Independence against England and in 1306 was crowned king at Scone. But after two defeats in that same year, he was forced to flee, probably to the island of Rathlin off the north coast of Ireland. When he heard that his last castle had been seized by the English, his wife imprisoned and his brother killed, Bruce fell into despair. A modern author recounts what happened next.
As he lay on his bed, wretchedly trying to decide whether to resign all attempts to restore freedom to Scotland, he noticed a spider hanging from the roof of the cabin, or some say cave, on a long thread. The spider was trying to swing itself from one roof beam to another to secure the thread for spinning its web. On its sixth unsuccessful attempt, Bruce spied an analogy with his own situation. He had fought six battles against the English without success. He decided that if the spider should secure its thread on its seventh attempt, he would try his luck in Scotland one more time. If it failed, he would go to the wars in Palestine and never return to his homeland. The legend goes that the spider made an almighty effort and secured its thread.
Bruce kept his word, and after many victories, became the unchallenged King of Scotland. As for the legend of the spider, it was referred to by Sir Walter Scott in his Tales of a Grandfather.
I have often met with people of the name of Bruce, so completely persuaded of the truth of this story, that they would not on any account kill a spider, because it was that insect which had shown the example of perseverance and given a signal of good luck to their great namesake.